Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Welcome to episode 19. Today I'm going to talk about sunsets. Well, not just sunsets, but dramatic sunsets. When the sky starts to turn orange then red as the sun goes down, it can make an amazing spectacle and your emotions will run riot and you might not think much about what you're shooting. A common mistake, not just with sunsets but with any kind of photography, is getting so carried away with what you're seeing that you don't think about how you shoot it. You expect that no matter how you compose the image, the emotions will carry through to the viewer of the image at a later time. However, this is rarely the case. The viewer will not have been through the experiences that you have to get to the place that you made the exposure. They don't feel the temperature of the atmosphere around you, the fatigue that you experience when climbing the mountain, say, to get to your vantage point. The exhilaration of the wind or the excitement of others around you when things start to go right. Without these and many other factors that come into play, the viewer will basically be relying on your image alone to incite an emotion. In this episode, I'll introduce some of my sunset shots, including my first successful sunset that I still have hanging on my living room wall today, which was shot in 1993. I'll also show you another shot from the top of a ferry from October 2003, and three shots from yesterday, January the 9th, 2006, that have really prompted me to talk about sunsets today. As usual, as these are real-world examples of how to make this kind of photo, I'll also talk you through how I went about getting these shots and what makes them work for me. I usually try to progress in chronological order when introducing my images, but today I'm going to work back from the present day to my earliest shot from 1993. There's no particular reason for this other than the sun is further past the horizon as the shots progress. It just seems more natural to talk about them that way for today. So Monday the 9th of January was a national holiday in Japan, so I'd got the day off of my day job. I'd had a pretty crappy weekend, having problems with an upgrade to the forum software at my website, and I'd spent two very nice days, weather-wise, very nice days inside in front of my computer, and I was feeling pretty down. The weather on Monday was not as good as the previous 2 days, as there was lots of cloud in the sky, almost overcast for most of the day. So I was also pretty annoyed, having spent the best 2 days in front of the computer, working on things that were not going as well as they could. However, I'm a firm believer that fair weather photographers limit themselves to only a small amount of possible photographic opportunities that nature has to offer. So I started to think of how I could capitalize on the overcast and broken cloud. Sunsets are, in my experience, best when there's a certain amount of cloud around to both add interest and to reflect the warm light. The thing is, you never know for sure if a sunset will be orange and red, or the sun will just go down uneventfully, either in full view or behind the clouds. Anyway, I recalled a spot that I'd visited some 5 years ago, and started thinking that if conditions were good, it would make a great spot for a sunset. In October 2001, I'd actually hiked to this spot from another mountain. It was a pretty grueling day, with lots of ups and downs, and all along mountain paths. Most mountains in Japan are pretty densely wooded, so you usually can't see anything either until you get to the very top of the main peak, which usually has a number of picnic areas, sometimes some little shacks that serve snacks and drinks, and also serve as a place to get warm in the winter months. This point, the peak of Mount Jimba, or Jimbasan, is very much like this. There are some four or five shacks and lots of man-made platforms to sit and eat and rest. One of the main reasons for this is because on a clear day, you get an excellent view of Mount Fuji. On the day I visited in 2001 after reaching this peak, I descended via a few hundred log steps to a car park. It takes only about 10 minutes, though when using public transport, as I was that day, you have to then walk quite a way to the nearest town to the closest bus stop. I remember thinking, though, that if I had a car, I would be able to park right here and probably get to the top in just 15 minutes or so. And this is exactly what I did yesterday. I must admit that it was a bit of a lung-bursting climb, pretty much just step after step, with only a very little flat ground in the middle, but basically just climbing steps. And after about 15 minutes, maybe 20, I was standing on the top of Mount Jimba. So Mount Fuji was not visible when I got to the top. I started thinking that maybe I'd be out of luck, but the haze in the mountains meant that the surrounding mountains that got further away became lighter in shade until they were no longer visible. As the sun set, if the sky turned orange, it would make a nice shot, so maybe all was not lost. Take a look at the first shot from this day, which is number 825 on my website, martinbaileyphotography.com. This is the first of three that we'll be looking at from this vantage point. This shows the effect very well that I just mentioned of the mountains as they fade into the distance. It was shot at f11 at 1/100th of a second with my 100 to 400 millimeter f4.5 to 5.6L lens at a focal length of 115 millimeters. So why did I use this lens? Well, there are two reasons. Firstly, if I'd gone with a wide angle lens or even a standard lens of say 50 millimeters, I would not have gotten close enough to the scene to show anything of interest. Also, telephoto lenses compact the perspective, making objects seem stacked up against each other. The result is the mountains, as they get less and less visible and defined, seem to all stack up on top of each other. And also, and you'll probably not be able to appreciate this very much on the smaller image that I have on the web or in iTunes, but in the foot of the valley, in the foreground, the sunlight is reflecting off the roofs of the houses. This helps to give the shot some focus. This, with the stacked up mountains, adds greatly to the drama of the image, but this is still more of a landscape shot than a dramatic sunset. The orange clouds help us to know that the end of the day is near, though, I guess. Now, before this, before the sky started to turn orange at all, I'd spoken with a guy working at one of the shacks on the top of the mountain, the only one operating on this day, and he'd commented that it was a shame that we couldn't see Mount Fuji today, and seemed pretty certain that it would not be visible at all. After I'd mentioned how beautiful I found the misty stacking effect of the mountains, though, he told me roughly where the sun would go down, so that maybe all would not be lost. Well, I decided to hang around for a little while in the hope that the sky would turn orange, as it did in the shot I just showed you, and it was starting to pay off. Now, let's look at the next shot, which is shot number 827. You can see from this that the heavy cloud in the top of the frame had parted, allowing the sun to be almost visible through the haze, but more importantly, Mount Fuji had, against the odds, showed itself through the broken clouds. Again, there is the stacking effect of the surrounding mountains, but with the cloud and the hazy sun and the icon of Japan in the frame, this makes for a very dramatic shot. I've actually put this into my landscape album on the website and not the sunsets album, as this to me is much more than just another sunset. Again, this is one that might be one of those images that can only truly be appreciated when viewed in a large print, to allow one to pore over the details. This too was shot with my 100-400mm lens at 135mm, f8 this time for 200th of a second. Oh, and by the way, both of these shots and the next one were shot at ISO 100. Before moving on to the next image, I'd like to briefly talk about how much equipment I take when I'm shooting. I know that many people try to think ahead to what they will need and take only the bare minimum to save energy. Especially when climbing or extensive walking is involved, this is obviously something that we need to do. But if you are going to go somewhere to make photos, getting the shot is also important. I've been in parks photographing birds. You know, it's probably not going to take any more, much more effort to take a few more pieces of equipment along. But I've been there and I've heard people saying, you know, oh, I wish I'd bought my long lens, or I wish I'd bought my extender. You know, don't wish for these things. The only person that can get your equipment to the shoot is you. I do take far too much equipment with me when I leave the house, I know. My backpack for a regular day out weighs about 14 kilograms or 30 pounds. As I take just about everything that I have, not everything, but I take a lot of lenses. And a lot of the time it's just in case. And granted, I often take them home in the evening, having not even taken them out of my bag. But I would rather struggle with a little heavier bag than miss the shot. Please don't misunderstand me. If I was doing the original hike that got me to this peak across multiple mountains, I'd have travelled more lightly. Had I not, I would not only have gotten much more tired, I might have even endangered myself. I may not have made it from across the mountains. But when possible, if you're not hiking long distances, take as much of your kit as you think you might need. Because taking it home unused is much less stressful than being somewhere and needing it, but it's sitting at home. Anyway, I'm bringing this up because many people would leave the big heavy 100 to 400 millimeter lens at home if they were going to have to climb up a few hundred stairs with it on their back. Believe me, taking the right gear is what's going to separate you from the amateurs. Next, let's take a look at shot number 829. The final shot from this vantage point on top of Mount Jimba. This shot was taken again with the 100 to 400 millimeter lens, this time at 310 millimeters at f11 for a 30th of a second. I've filled the screen with the iconic Mount Fuji, and I really wanted to just illustrate here my point about the stacking effect with telephoto lenses. With the increased focal length this image was made at, you'll see how the mountains in the foreground are now severely stacked together, making for quite a dramatic statement about this mountain. You can probably tell that I have a lot of strong feelings for Mount Fuji, which is perhaps swaying my judgment a little. You know, going back to the statement I made earlier about being or getting over emotional about your own shots, excited when you're shooting, can sometimes change the way you think about how you're shooting it. I do get excited when I'm photographing Mount Fuji, but I still try to make sure that I can bring this drama across to the viewers of the photos, and I'd like to think that I do this amazing volcano justice in my work. So moving on, the next shot, which is number 190, is another one of my favorite sunsets. This was shot from the deck of a ferry heading towards the island of Sado, which can be seen in the bottom of the shot. With so much of the sky aflame with these fingers of cloud radiating out from the island, this is one sunset for which a wide-angle lens was useful. I shot this at 17mm on my 10D, which means an actual focal length of 27mm, at f6.3 for a 50th of a second, at ISO 100. This shot for me has a lot going for it, with the island in silhouette and the sky reflecting in the calm sea. I'm including this not just because it's one of my favourite sunsets, but also to give you a tip that many of the best sunsets often occur within 10, 20 or more minutes or so after the sun has dropped below the horizon. I'd been shooting this sunset as it evolved over the space of 30 minutes or so, and I think that I'd actually just about given up, and I didn't think it was going to get any better. I'd got friends waiting for me inside the ferry, and I needed to get back to them. So I was heading back. I must have been annoying them, spending so much time out on the outer deck, away from those, while these guys were all getting warm inside. But as I started to head back, the sky burst further into colour. I'd learned from these experiences that the sun, once it's gone down below the horizon, is not the end of a sunset. Don't pack away your gear and start to head home. Give it another 10 or 20 minutes, you never know what will happen. So finally, here is one of my first shots that I uploaded to my website. It's number 20. And as I said in the introduction for today's episode, I still have a print of this shot hanging on my living room wall. On the day that I made this image, I was sitting at home. It was back in 1993, when for some reason, I can't remember why right now, but I felt that there was going to be a nice sunset this day. So I jumped into my car and drove to this point as fast as I could. It is a place called Shirafu Pass that winds its way through the mountains between Fukushima City and the Urabandai area. It takes about 30 to 40 minutes to drive, the way I drove that day at least. And as I got closer and closer, the sky started to fill with colour, and I recall that I was panicking a little, thinking that maybe it would be all over by the time I got to this spot. I did get there just as the sun was about to drop below the horizon. And once again, as you can see from this shot, during the time after the sun had disappeared, the sky contained a lot of colour. For this shot, though, the sky, although a beautiful colour, contained no real drama. There's actually a star that you can see in the top left-hand corner. It's like one pixel or so, I think, on the website. Anyway, it was the uneventful but colourful sky that was the reason for my returning to this particular spot this day. I'd noticed this dead tree at the side of the road when passing this point previously, and thought to myself how beautiful it would look in these conditions. And I'd imagined the drama that would be created by the tree, and, you know, with the woods and the hills in the background. But it needed to have this sky. So here is one, probably the biggest takeaway for you from this week's episode. In addition to amazing photography and photographic philosophies, Ansel Adams left many wonderful quotes. One of my favourites and one of the most useful pieces of advice I continue to give myself from one of Ansel's quotes is, "In my mind's eye, I visualise how a particular sight and feeling will appear on a print. If it excites me, there is a good chance it will make a good photograph. It is an intuitive sense, an ability that comes from a lot of practice." Now, what I get from this is, you know, the ability to visualize the end product, be it a print or something that you'll view on a computer screen, it will help you greatly in your photography if you can visualize the end product. When I'm out and about, I'm constantly looking for subjects for photos. You know, I can be walking along the street, I don't even have a camera with me, and people often say that I'm looking at things in a strange way, or I'm looking at things in a way that they don't usually see people looking at things. And basically what I'm doing is I'm eyeing everything up as a photograph. I'm trying to envisage what it would look like under certain conditions. Things that excite me often end up getting captured, as Ansel advises. When you find a great subject, don't just look at it under the conditions in which you find it. Think about what that place would look like at a different time of day or a different time of year. Midday has much harsher light than early morning and the light at the end of the day. If you turn up very early in the morning, there might also be layers of mist to add to the mood, or maybe even dew on the ground that will reflect the early morning sunlight. Think of what the place would look like if it was raining or snowing. What would it look like in the moonlight, for example? Limiting yourself to the scene as you find it could limit your creativity, and we don't want that to happen. So I guess that's about it for this week. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope it helped you in some way in your never-ending quest to become an even better photographer. If it does help, why not spread the word about Martin Bailey Photography? The podcast forum, I'm often hearing, you know, people say, how can we give Martin something back for his knowledge and experience as a photographer that I relay to you via the podcast. And, you know, I generally don't do this to get anything back. I am doing it because of my love of photography. If I can help out, it would be great. But if you do want to give something back, then how about mailing as many people as you can think of and telling them about this podcast? Email them a link to the podcast feed or the podcast page. Or maybe even just email people a link to my website. Now, the publicity is one thing that I obviously cannot get enough of as a photographer. So, you know, push my name around a little. If you feel that you would like to give something back. If you don't, just take away what you get. I really don't ask for anything more. So that's it. I'm going to leave you with that. I hope that it has been useful, as I say. Thanks very much for listening, and happy shooting for the next week, and I'll speak to you again next week. Goodbye.
This has been a Martin Bailey Photography Podcast.